From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Massachusetts DAs say they'll dismiss nearly 6,000 drug convictions associated with the admitted misconduct of a former state drug lab chemist.
From the time she started working until the day she was arrested, she committed fraud after fraud after fraud.
Also today, why Boston and Israel are forming one of the fastest-growing partnerships in the cybersecurity sector.
Why you move to Boston and not to Silicon Valley? It's like we hear that question like back in the day a lot. And today we're not hearing this question anymore in Tel Aviv. Nobody is asking us why you move to Boston.
Plus, the latest on accusations of sexual misconduct by the founding artistic director of the Gloucester Stage Company. And Rob Capello on what makes Mozart's Symphony No. 40 great. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts prosecutors are dismissing roughly 6,000 criminal drug cases because of misconduct by a former state chemist and two former state prosecutors with the Attorney General's office. Chemist Sonia Farrick pleaded guilty in 2014 to stealing drug samples and using drugs while working at a state drug lab in Amherst. Today, Randy Gioia, an attorney for the Public Defender Division of the Committee for Public Counsel Services, applauded the decision to dismiss the cases associated with Farrick.
Sonia Farrakh was a state chemist at the Massachusetts Drug Lab in Amherst. She started working at the lab in 2004. From the time she started working until the day she was arrested, she committed fraud after fraud after fraud. She corrupted thousands of cases.
WBUR's Deborah Becker has been following this very closely for some time, and she joins us now. Hi there, Deb.
Hello, Meghna.
So first of all, Deb, break down today's developments for us. I mean, this has been going on for years in Massachusetts.
That's right. Years of litigation over crimes committed by Sonia Farrakh. So the American Civil Liberties Union and the State Public Defender Agency, the Committee for Public Counsel Services, which is also called CPCS for short, they both filed suit on behalf of two defendants who were convicted of drug crimes that were based on Sonia Farrakh's testing, and their suit charges that prosecutors never notified them or their attorneys about Farrakh's misconduct or misconduct by the state attorney general's office. Here's one of the defendants, Nicole Westcott of Granby. She spoke at a press conference today and said having a conviction on her record made it difficult for her to get jobs, to get housing, and to get custody of her son.
I've been in sobriety for about 4 years now, and you know, just trying to build a new life and, like, become a functioning human, civilian human, human was hard.
And so her conviction will be dismissed because of today's decisions by prosecutors. And Westcott also now says she works with others and hopes that bringing her case forward will give people hope.
Okay. So remind us then in more detail, Deb, about the role of the Attorney General's office in all of this.
Okay. So Sonia Farrakh's misconduct was compounded by two former state assistant attorneys general who withheld evidence regarding the scope of Farrakh's crimes. So that went before a judge in Springfield. And last June, that judge ruled that these two prosecutors committed a, quote, fraud upon the court and said that that exacerbated the extent of Farrakh's misconduct. And here's what CPCS attorney Rebecca Jacobstein said today.
Because of the Attorney General's office's deception and withholding of crucial evidence, the court ordered these people, my clients, our clients, to leave their homes, leave their families, and report back to prison. One of my clients had to go back and serve 15 more months, 15 months he would not otherwise have had to serve.
And so essentially there, Meghna, what she's talking about is that some clients were released once there was evidence of misconduct, but then when the scope of the evidence was narrowed, allegedly by the former assistant attorney general's misconduct, then people were sent back to prison. Now, we should say these two former AGs no longer work in the AG's office, and this was not under current Attorney General Maura Healey.
Right.
But Healey did release a statement today, and it says, quote, "It's unfortunate that the ACLU chose to stage a press conference without reading the AG's brief filed in this case, which calls for speedy relief for all of these defendants. Sonia Farrick's crimes were egregious, and as our filings make clear, this office has been working hard to resolve these cases as quickly as possible. Staff in the AG's office have been working hard for months to identify Farrick defendants. For the ACLU to suggest otherwise is false and irresponsible." That's according to Attorney General Maura Healey's office.
Okay, so that brings us then to today and the announcement of the 6,000 cases that are going to be dismissed. Huge number. Which counties were hit hardest?
Well, Hampden County, of course, because the lab was in Amherst, in Western Mass. So about 4,000 cases were dismissed in Hampden County. And we should say the reason today we're talking about this is because today was the deadline that was set by State Supreme Court Justice Frank Gaziano. So he has been reviewing this case, and he told prosecutors and the attorney general that the deadline was December 1 for them to submit their list of cases. So they're all coming in today. Hampden, 4,000 cases. Northwestern, almost 1,500 cases. Suffolk, 134. Essex says it's going to dismiss all cases based on evidence that was tested by Sonia Farrick, but it didn't release a number. It says it will do that next week. It was less than 500. And Norfolk just released a statement saying 76 defendants. We are still waiting from the other district attorneys to release or submit to the court their list today.
Okay. So, Deb, my mind's going back to where we started, which is that this has been going on for years in Massachusetts. Why did it take us so long to get to this point?
Well, basically, this is how the legal system works. It's been going through lawsuit after lawsuit, lower courts, until it got up to the Supreme Judicial Court. The ACLU pointed out today that none of these dismissals might have happened had the ACLU and CPCS not taken legal action. And the ACLU says it's going to continue to work on reforms in the future. So if there is evidence of misconduct, prosecutors will be required to notify people and steps will be taken. Here's Carol Rose. She's an attorney with the ACLU.
It's time to hold accountable all elected leaders, including elected DAs, to ensure that when the system fails so many people, it should not require the ACLU and CPCS litigation for people to do the right thing.
And Rose also said today, reminded folks, that this is the second major scandal involving a former state chemist.
Right.
Both of these scandals are being resolved apparently in similar ways through litigation. In the case of the other chemist, this was Annie Ducon. And this summer, after years of litigation, the SJC agreed to dismiss more than 20,000 criminal cases that were based on evidence that was tested by Annie Ducon. She, as you probably remember, was arrested in 2012. For widespread evidence tampering at the former Hinton State Drug Lab in Jamaica Plain, and she served 3 years in prison.
So, Deb, what is likely to happen now, then?
Well,
or next?
Right. Yeah. Well, now the SJC has to decide if it is going to formally dismiss these 6,000 cases that were submitted today, and that is expected. But the ACLU did say today that it's suggesting that it is going to take steps in the future to try to reform the criminal justice system as it pertains to forensic testing.
That's WBUR senior correspondent and host Deborah Becker. Deb, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, news today that's shaking the New England theater world. 9 women have come forward to the New York Times accusing celebrated playwright Israel Horovitz of sexual harassment and rape. Horovitz is an award-winning, internationally recognized playwright and the founding artistic director of the Gloucester Stage Company. The incidents reported to the New York Times took place over the years Horovitz was with the Gloucester Stage Company. They include accusations that he forcibly kissed teenagers, groped young women, and allegedly raped a 19-year-old. The women who spoke to the Times all agreed to be identified by their real names. Today, the Gloucester Stage Company says that it has ended its relationship with Horovitz. The playwright himself told the Times that he has, quote, a different memory of some of these events, and that he apologizes with all his heart to, quote, any woman who has ever felt compromised by his actions. But here's the thing. Close watchers of the New England theater scene might remember that nearly a quarter century ago, the now-defunct Boston Phoenix published a carefully reported, explosive story detailing similar accusations against Horovitz. Back then, both Horovitz and the Gloucester Stage Company vehemently denied the allegations. Bill Marks reported that story for the Phoenix back in 1993. He's now editor of the Arts Fuse, an online Boston arts magazine, and he joins us. Bill, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So first of all, the New York Times did acknowledge that you reported on issues with Israel Horovitz, what, almost 25 years ago? I mean, what's your reaction that women felt confident enough now to step forward using their names?
Well, I'm overjoyed that, you know, that in a sense, I don't want to say it's a vindication, but when I get first reported on it back in 1993, the women were afraid to put forth their names, and they all wanted to remain anonymous. And so it's just so great, and it shows the changing times that women are now willing. I would have loved for them to go on the record when I interviewed them, and the Phoenix definitely was pressing me to have that happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm so happy that now women feel empowered and have the confidence to put their names to what they're saying.
Well, so Bill, let me ask you, are any of the women who were willing to provide their names and their stories to the New York Times today, are any of them the same women you spoke to 24 years ago?
I believe so. And I only say I believe so because when I did the story back in 1993, the Phoenix was afraid that Israel Horovitz would sue. So they wanted all my notes. So all the notes I took, everything basically was handed over to the Phoenix. And so when I was asked about, well, do I remember the names and, you know, of the women that I interviewed back in 1993, I must admit it's been this many years, like I had a hard time remembering. So I believe there are some, yes.
Okay. And sadly, the Phoenix itself is no more.
Sadly.
Yeah. So tell me, though, I mean, over the past 25 years or so, how much of this has been an open secret in the New England theater world?
Well, I get the impression, and, you know, I mean, when I did the stories, I was open to hear more. And, of course, I was disappointed with what the reaction was at Gloucester Stage in terms of handling it. But I didn't, to be honest, I didn't hear a lot of other, you know, I didn't get other anonymous notes. I didn't get a lot of things telling me that it was going on. But now I'm hearing through Facebook, and I began hearing it over the past few months, that it was a bit of an open secret here, that there were many women who knew exactly what was going on with him.
Mm. So back in the early 90s, when you reported your stories, you got significant pushback from the Gloucester Stage Company, the company itself. I mean, board members told you that the women making the accusations were, quote, tightly wound.
Yes, that was Barry Weiner, the head of the board. Yeah, well, they wanted, you know, I wanted to cover all the angles. And so I did interview board members. I interviewed as many as I could, would be willing to go on the record and speak to me. And yeah, they did kick back quite hard and say they were going to do something. They're going to post something on their bulletin board. They're going to, you know, do something with their policy there. But yeah, it was heavily denied. Israel Horovitz was on record, I think, in the Boston Globe saying that it was a piece of character assassination.
Yeah.
And the women themselves, you know, the voices of the women simply were not taken seriously. And then, alas, soon somewhat forgotten, or at least it's just the issue just seemed to vanish. People wanted to get back to normal, quote unquote, you know, as soon as possible.
So contrast that to what Israel Horovitz himself told the New York Times for its reporting out today. I mean, he didn't necessarily deny the accusations. He says he remembers the incidents as being different, but apologized for any harm he may have caused. Even more interesting, his son, Adam, says he stands with the women who've accused his father, and he believes them completely. I mean, how different is that from when, you know, you did your stories? Were you surprised by Horovitz now?
Night and day. I mean, it's ironic because, remember, my story came not that far after Anita Hill. So the incident was in the air, and that was part of what propelled me to do it, and I'm sure it was part of propelled the Phoenix to go ahead and post a piece, you know, I mean, to publish a piece, even though, you know, we didn't have the names. I mean, then he felt quite comfortable denying it. I mean, the Globe essentially gave him a column where he essentially just said that none of this is true and it's character assassination, and never did any real follow-up on the original stories.
So let's take a step back here for a second, Bill, if we can. I mean, how important, how influential is Israel Horovitz in the theater community here in New England?
Well, I would say it was very, you know, Gloucester Stage is one of the major small, you know, certainly up in, you know, in the Gloucester area is a major theater. He's a figure who's known in New York for his activity off-Broadway. He's written over 70 plays. He just recently directed his first film. He's written a number of screenplays. So he is a significant figure in the American theater.
So what impact, then, could this latest round of revelations about Horowitz, which, you know, now, as we know, we've known for 25 years.
For 25 years.
What impact is this going to have on the Gloucester Stage Company itself today?
I mean, they seem to be moving away from Israel Horowitz as quickly as possible. And as you pointed out, even his son is essentially agreeing that there is something to the charges. So my assumption is that they're going to, you know, they will essentially be moving away, backing away from him. I mean, my basic feeling is that I'm hoping the impact has more to do with the theater community and with the media. 25 years, this news was out, and no one followed up, and things are allowed to go back to normal. So what I'm hoping now is that local media, would anyone be surprised if there wasn't other things like this going on in the theater community today? And I think that this should be looked into, and there should be a more active approach to what's going on, rather than having it happen again, you know what I mean, in another 25 years before we actually become concerned enough to actually do something about this.
Right. Well, Bill Marks is editor of The Arts Fuse, and about 25 years ago, he had some of the original reporting on accusations of sexual assault and harassment on the part of Israel Horowitz. That reporting appeared in the then Boston Phoenix. We'll put links to all of that at our website, radioboston.org. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I should just say, I still miss the Phoenix. Now, we should also note that Israel Horowitz did not return our request for interviews. Leadership at the Gloucester Stage Company declined our interview request as well. But in a statement, Board President Liz Neumeier said the board is appalled by the allegations. The statement went on to say, quote, "Our hearts go out to the many women who are, once again, reliving the harassment and assaults they endured. We recognize that in the past, their reports were grossly mishandled. The board is united and committed to ensuring that such behavior does not take place at Gloucester Stage, and we will take any reports seriously," end quote. Now, we've got more news on the issue of sexual harassment. The Boston Globe is reporting just this afternoon that State Senate President Stan Rosenberg's husband has allegedly sexually assaulted and harassed four men over the past 3 years. According to the Globe, President Rosenberg's husband, Brian Hefner, grabbed the genitals of three of the men and forcibly kissed one of them. The Globe says it has not found any evidence that the Senate president knew about the assaults and that the men feared reporting the allegations to Rosenberg or authorities because of how it could affect their careers. In a statement, Brian Hefner told the Globe that he was shocked to learn of the allegations and that, quote, "it is incredibly difficult to respond to allegations by unnamed and unidentified individuals that involved an extended period of time, particularly in the current environment." Senate President Stan Rosenberg said in his statement that, quote, "to the best of my recollection, I was not approached by anyone with complaints during or after the alleged incidents made in this article, or I would have tried to intervene." We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, one of the inevitable side effects of a world in constant connection is that we're all much more likely to get hacked. But take heart, because Boston has quickly become a leading developer of new cybersecurity technologies. And Asma Khalid, who leads WBUR's business and technology team Bostonomics, has been looking into why the city has a ballooning cybersecurity sector. And she found something interesting. The region's successes may be connected to the country of Israel. And Asma joins us now. It's good to see you.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so tell us more. What do you mean that part of what's happening here is tied to Israel?
Right. So, Meghna, I think in order to really understand what that means, you need to understand the ecosystem in Israel. And I spoke with the Israeli Consul General to New England. His name is Yehudi Yaakov, and let's take a listen to what he had to say.
Israel is no doubt the epicenter of global cyber activity today. This didn't happen by accident. You have the R&D activities going on in the military. You have the policies being pushed by the government This feeds into the business world and the academic world.
And so, Meghna, I don't know if folks are familiar with this, but military service is mandatory in Israel. And you have people learning cyber skills and then sort of cycling out through this conveyor belt into the private sector. And so, you know, he told me that Israel saw that cyber would essentially be the new frontier for warfare.
Right. So, I mean, a very security-minded state to begin with, it makes perfect sense that they would look at the internet and say, this is an area of potential vulnerability that they need to
address.
Totally.
And you have that sort of ecosystem, right, because people go from the military into the private
sector.
Exactly.
Okay, so what about the relationship then between Israel and the Boston area? When did that start?
So I asked a bunch of people this question, and I heard different answers. You know, Yehudi Yaakov pointed me to when Akamai and EMC first set up centers in Israel, both of these companies Boston-based. You know, EMC is now merged with Dell, but they both have centers in Israel and have had centers there for a number of years. And then I also spoke with a venture capitalist. His name is Jeff Fagnan. He's with Accomplice. It's a firm in Cambridge. I wanted to get a sense of when they were first sort of tipped off to this industry in Boston.
We started investing in cyber before it was probably mainstream and hip to invest in cyber. So like a lot of the cyber companies that we've invested in, we started investing in 2004. We brought CyberArk over from Israel in, you know, in early 2000 timeframe.
And so, Meghna, he was actually one of the first people who showed me the sort of importance, I would say, of Israel in understanding the Boston ecosystem. Jeff talked to me about Israel being really a sort of huge factor, but at the same time also pointed out that, you know, two of the largest Massachusetts-based cybersecurity companies, both Carbon Black and Rapid7, they have more U.S.-based ties.
So just a quick question here. CyberArk that he referred to, is it one of the cybersecurity companies that the VC firm brought over to Boston from Israel?
So, you know, it's interesting because CyberArk is this company that now is, it has a U.S. headquarters in Newton. It is still globally headquartered in Israel, but it had its IPO in 2014 and was considered, you know, sort of a very public fanfare IPO. It's considered to be one of the sort of success stories you hear in terms of Israeli companies choosing to come to Boston.
I see. Now, did you talk to Fagnan about sort of whether or not the business environment or the tech environment here in Boston makes for closer or eases the way for closer ties between the Boston area and Israel?
Right. That's the thing we always hear about, too, right, with Boston having its talent workforce, yeah, right, and the academic institutions here. And what Jeff told me that was interesting is he said, you know, a lot of times Boston looks at Silicon Valley with sort of, I mean, well, he didn't say this, but I could say this, is sort of envy, right, yeah, of the idea that things haven't worked out the way that it always was meant to be. And he actually referred to this period, I would say, in the early 2000s. He said a lot of venture capital firms, they missed that first wave of the internet. And it was kind of the dark ages for New England. And he said cybersecurity is really different in part because it plays to what is inherent in the DNA of Boston's tech ecosystem.
Silicon Valley is known for a lot of consumer technology. Boston's not. If you look at where New England's been strong, physics, you know, machine learning, data science, networking, big, you know, big computing that has lots of processing power. And that's the kind of stuff you need if you're going to build cybersecurity.
Sounds pretty good. I mean, the way he's putting it. But what about then the people required to build these companies, talent always being a factor here?
Yeah. So talent is a factor. And I will say I spoke with one Israeli founded company as well, who mentioned to me that that was one of the attractions in terms of why they decided to come to Boston. They said that not only are you looking at people who understand the tech, but they needed people in, say, marketing and sales, and that people had this sort of fundamental understanding of cybersecurity and its importance. But Meghna, the other thing that I thought was really interesting is people talk to me about the market and why this is so different than Silicon Valley, right? You know, you think about the market for cybersecurity, it's big banks, it's hospitals, pharma companies, sometimes government contractors, yeah, and these are all East Coast-centered industries, right? And so if you are a cybersecurity company, you want to be close to your market. And in this case, your market is East Coast-centered. And that's what I actually heard from Lior Deef. He's the CEO of Cyber Reason. It's an Israeli-founded company that has made Boston its headquarters. Lior himself was in the Israeli army. He was part of the cyber team, you know, thwarting attacks, using intelligence and whatnot. And he talked to me about why they chose Boston.
In 2012, we decided to move to Boston. And the reason that we choose Boston is a fewfold. One is, you know, we believe that most of our customers exist in the East Coast. The second thing, the amount of talent pool that exists.
Okay, so another nod there to the talent pool, Asma. But were there also other sort of practical reasons why Boston may be a great place for these companies?
Yeah, Lior told me that, you know, you can't really overestimate the idea of just being three time zones closer to Tel Aviv. Three time zones being if you were on the West Coast, you'd be 3 hours further behind. And they have their entire R&D team in Israel, as do other Israeli-founded companies. And so that time zone and accessibility is important, as well as the fact that there are now direct flights between Boston and Tel Aviv. But one thing he told me that I thought was really interesting is he said that when they first chose to move to Boston, and he would tell this to people in Tel Aviv, they kind of looked at him somewhat skeptically.
When we moved to here 4 years ago, it was, you know, very weird. Why you move to Boston and not to Silicon Valley? It's like we hear that question like back in the day a lot. And today we are not hearing this question anymore in Tel Aviv. Nobody is asking us why you moved to Boston. It's almost obvious that Boston, this is a place that you can move if you want to be closer to the market.
Which I thought was really interesting, right? I mean, they still have their essentially their R&D facility in Israel, as do other companies. But in terms of so many of the other operations of the company, they've chose Boston. And he says, you know, look, they had around three dozen people 2 years ago. They're now essentially taking up a floor of the John Hancock building. And they have been growing very, very rapidly and have gotten a major cash infusion of over $100 million from SoftBank.
Wow, just over the past couple of years. Then. Mm-hmm. Wow. So a huge growth with this one company, for example. Mm-hmm. But what does it tell us about the scale of the cyber industry as a whole here?
Right, Meghna, I think that's so hard to quantify. Jeff Fagnan, right, from Accomplice, the venture capital firm, he actually told me that he felt like the place is overcrowded. Granted, he also is someone who says that he was an early investor,
and
right?
There is competition now,
and there is competition. Yeah. But he also made the point that it's somewhat hard to differentiate all of these smaller startups in the cybersecurity realm because they're so much, right? But I think what's interesting, and this is all kind of anecdata, is you look at the success of individual companies, right? So you can look at a company like Carbon Black, right? This is a company that's become kind of like a pillar institution, and you now have people who started in the early days of Carbon Black who've left. And Jeff told me that they've actually invested in three companies by people who used to work at Carbon Black, right? Uh-huh. So you start to have that cycle. So that's one thing that I think is really interesting. The other thing that I would say is just sort of, again, kind of an abstract data point is that the New England Israel Business Council actually tried to essentially look at what the cybersecurity ecosystem, what that relationship looks like. And they looked at a company, CyberArk, Israeli founded, and found that it protects 40% of Fortune 1000 companies.
Wow.
Right? I mean, so you can sort of just look at the customer base. And that to me, Meghna, is a really interesting story because you have all these anecdotal data points, right? And you have these companies who have been moving here, and then either they spin out new companies, or at this point, as Lior said, the ecosystem now back in Tel Aviv is, if you want to come to the U.S., hey, you really ought to think about coming to Boston.
Yeah. Well, Asma Khalid, she leads Bostonomics WBUR's business and technology team. Totally fascinating, Asma. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Meghna.
Let me repeat that. 18 wins, 4 losses. That is the Celtics' amazing record. Can they keep up their momentum tonight against the 76ers? I'm just going to say yes. Why not? I'm the eternal optimist, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, who's here to beat back my optimism about the Celts.
Not a bit of it.
Okay, good. I'm glad because even Golden State, right? The Golden State coach says the Celtics are the team of the future in the East. Is he right?
No. They're the team of the present.
Of the present!
And he's absolutely wrong. This happens every once in a while. I remember years ago when somebody said, you know, in 2 years, the Cleveland Indians are going to be really great. And then they were great that year. So I think the Celtics are the team of the present. And of course, the winning streak is over. And that was the 16-game winning streak was the thing that got lots of people interested who might not otherwise have cared about the Celtics at this point in the year particularly. But winning streaks are not really the point in the NBA. It's a very long season, and the point is to keep everybody healthy, to distribute the minutes so nobody's angry at the coach, and to keep everybody buying into whatever system the coach has developed for the team to continue moving forward. And so far, that's been the thing that has impressed me most about the Celtics. It's
right.
The extent to which everybody on the roster is contributing. And even on nights when they aren't able to put together that great third quarter or fourth quarter, Blackwater comeback, they still look as if they all know what they're doing. They all know their roles, and they're playing magnificently well.
I mean, it's an even better or more laudable because so many of the guys are new.
Yeah, and some of those new guys obviously are tremendously important to what the Celtics have been able to accomplish.
Do you like how I lumped them all together?
And again, you know, you could talk about Al Horford. You can certainly talk about some of these new fellas, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum. But you have to give a tremendous amount of credit to the coach for kind of keeping this collection of people who don't know each other very well together.
Yeah. And also, I'm just glad that Yura and I don't have to debate on what makes a streak anymore, right? Because sometimes
not,
in the past, we've been here at this table saying, is two a streak? Is three? Now we know at least 16 constitutes a streak.
Yes. And around the NBA, there's no doubt that streak mattered.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's turn then to the NFL, because last night, a players coalition representing NFL players who have been protesting and taking a knee during the national anthem announced that they've reached a tentative deal with the league. The league's agreed to commit some $89 million over 7 years to social justice issues important to certain communities, specifically criminal justice reform, law enforcement, education. But the deal won't go into effect until it's agreed upon at the NFL's owners' meeting in December. So your take, Bill.
What could possibly go wrong there?
I tried to keep the doubt out of my voice.
Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical about this, just for a couple of reasons. One is the coalition that you mentioned has now splintered because some of them are perfectly happy to listen to the owners. As they say, we'll put a lot of money into some of these causes that matter to you. And some of them are saying, no, wait, this is coming with the proviso that we stop protesting. And even if that hasn't been explicitly stated, and some people say that it has, the implication is that we would have to stop taking a knee or raising our fists or doing whatever we're doing in order to express our dismay with the social circumstances in this country at this time. And they're not willing to do that. And more power to them. The league should not be able to buy off free speech.
Yeah. And I mean, on that point, of course, the agreement couldn't also include the proviso that they hope the president stops tweeting.
No, the president, as far as I know,
he's going to do what he wants.
Is unbound in all respects, including this one.
Yeah. But nevertheless, I mean, let's say that the owners in December do agree to go forward and commit and vote to commit almost $90 million. It's not an insignificant sum.
No, but how is it going to be committed? Where is it going to go? And if the committee that decides where the money goes is in fact dominated by ownership and league officials, which is what it looks like, according to what I've read, the players won't have the final say on where the money goes, and it will begin to resemble the kind of publicity campaign, public relations effort that the concussion settlement resembles, something that makes the league look good without really managing to address at all the dire circumstances of the players who suffer brain damage as a result of their work.
Yeah. Well, let's turn now to something not at all less controversial, Bill, and that is Russia and the Olympics.
Oh, no controversy
and doping.
Nobody even knows whether they'll be there.
Yes, because the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has until December 5th when they're going to make an announcement about whether or not the Russian team will be allowed to compete in the 2018 Winter Olympics. Again, ongoing controversy over systemic doping amongst Russian athletes. And just to add to it, yesterday the New York Times had excerpts from the diaries of Grigory Rodchenko. He's the former director of Russia's anti-doping lab, but who was implicated in helping Russian officials systemically dope athletes there. So I just want to make an aside point. Anyone who hasn't seen the documentary Icarus about Rodchenko, go to your Netflix queue right now and put it in. It's amazing. Okay, but anyway, as for the Russians in 2018, Bill, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think it's kind of amazing that we're at the end of November and nobody's sure whether they're going to be there or not. I mean, you know, the final coats of paint are going on the venue even as we speak. So that's part of what amazes me. And then the other is the various different ways that this could ultimately shake out. One is the Russians will be prohibited from participating in the Olympics at all. One is that some Russians will be prohibited and some will be able to come and compete. And one is that the Russians that do compete will have to compete in uniforms that bear no insignia of Russia, and there will be no Russian flags. And then another possibility is the Russians have announced that they may boycott the whole thing out of disgust for this entire series of events. The people that I feel, maybe this is a crazy way to view it, but the people that I feel a little bit sorry for are the athletes from other countries who would very much like to see the Olympics as an opportunity to compete against the very best athletes from around the world. And if you remember the two recent, fairly recent editions of the Olympics where there had been boycotts, one by the United States, by the then USSR, that was kind of what happened. That people sort of thought, oh, gee, yeah, somebody won a gold medal, but what a shame that some of the best athletes in the world weren't there to compete for it. It's not supposed to work out that way. And it's not that I'm sympathizing with a country that did systematic doping.
I was going to say, like,
quite obviously.
What's worse, not having the Russians there or having doped Russians there?
I still feel bad for the athletes who are competing and wish to compete against the best in the world.
Yeah. Well, Bill Littlefield is host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs on WBUR every Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And we love to have him every week here at Radio Boston as well. Thanks,
it's
Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor, often referred to as the Great G Minor Symphony. Well, what makes it so great? That's exactly what conductor, composer, and author Rob Capello is here to tell us. You may remember Capello for his What Makes It Great series, where he unveils, note by note, the hidden majesty within a piece. And Rob joins us now. Rob Capello, you are one of my favorite guests. Welcome back.
Oh, no pressure whatsoever. So great to be here.
I like to keep a high bar on this show.
You're one of my favorite hosts. How's that?
I'll take it. I'll take it. Whether you mean it or not, I'll take it. All right. So this piece, very famous. But what do you love about it specifically?
Well, you know, I think this is one of the pieces that I like to pick because everyone knows the beginning. Even if you don't know the title, I mean, let's face it, Symphony No. 40 in G minor is not the world's greatest title. But even if you don't know the title, everyone knows... You know, as a kid, you were told it was, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's Mozart, you know, and ruined it for life. But this is an absolutely fantastic piece. Now, I'm going to spend a whole hour on it at Jordan Hall on Sunday, but I'm going to give you a brief précis of what makes this fantastic piece great.
Okay, I'm all ears.
So let's take this beginning. I mean, the beginning is not so great. I mean, this tune... I mean, not that fantastic.
Cell phones have ruined it for
me, it's really. Nothing much. I mean, you have it once, you do it again, you do it a third time, then the big news, a leap. Great. So we're going to call this, and I'll now ruin it again for another generation of listeners, do it once, do it twice, and then leap up.
Okay.
So that's our first idea. Do it once, do it twice, and then leap up. Then you got the second half of the idea, which seems like it's totally unrelated. You go down a scale. Three notes down, three notes down, three notes down, down. Okay, sounds totally different, but they actually rhyme. They have the same rhythm. Ba-da-dum, 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 bum. Uh-huh. Same rhythm. Same rhythm as...
Two
different groups of people, Palestinians and Israelis, who seem like they have nothing in common, are actually connected by their fundamental humanity, by the rhythm behind them. So that's our idea. Let's get in our ears. That's our idea. Then we do the whole thing lower, so you get it in your ear. Three notes down, three notes down, three notes down. That's our idea. Now, a million things happen to it, but I just want to show you the amazing possibilities that he hears in this in the middle. So we come to the development section. We come to the middle of this thing where the plot thickens and where we find out what this all means. We come to the ending in the first part. Everything's fine. All of a sudden, we travel. Where are we? Oh, no. Huh? What key are we in? At this moment, we think we will never find a key ever again. We're lost. And suddenly, we think, okay, we're here. It's supposed to go, but instead it goes.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa, now I saw your eyebrows go up. That's It's working. The eyebrows go up. All right, so that doesn't work. Then we try it lower. That was a great eyebrow. And it should go. But instead it goes, we are still searching for a place, finding a home, okay? Then magic happens. I don't have time to do it. I'll skip it now. You come to Jordan Hall. You shouldn't miss what happens. I'm going to go to the heart of the thing. Okay, this idea is 8 bars long. But da 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 2, da 3, da 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 4, da da 5, da 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 6, da da 7, da 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 8. Like Beethoven, he starts looking for the essence of things. Peel away all the inessentials. Let's get to the heart of the story. Mm. Let's get to what the lead is all about. 8 bars get reduced to 4 bars. 4 bars get reduced to 2 bars. 2 bars get reduced to 10 notes. Okay, now our original one was do it once, do it twice, and then leap up. Now we put it into what we would call like its prime form. You reduce it to only 10 notes and just 2 pitches. Just these 2 notes.
Mm-hmm.
10 notes. Once, do it twice, and then no leap. Just do it once, do it twice, and then repeat. This is like the prime form. Okay, violins do it by themselves. Do it once, do it twice, and then repeat. They do it higher. Do it once, do it twice, and then repeat.
Yeah.
The woodwinds reduce it even further. 10 notes is too much. Let's reduce it to just 6 notes. Do it once and then repeat. Do it higher. Do it once and then repeat. They overlap and make a stew out of it, a jambalaya. Higher. Search higher. I mean, you're just dying of tension here, right? Then we come to the climax. I skip, an amazing moment. Now, question for you, Magna. When I do the opening version...
I really was holding my breath there. Right, well, the tension is intense.
For 1 second, breathe. Now, okay. When I go like this, do I go down to the second note or up?
I feel you want to go up.
I want to, but it goes down the first time. So,
right.
So okay. We'll call do it once. We'll call it do it down.
Okay.
What do you think the upside down version of do it down would be?
Should be down.
Do it up. Exactly.
Yeah.
The whole universe is now reduced to nothing but either do it down or do it up. The first 3 notes of the symphony, you hear in the strings, they go do it up, do it down, do it down, do it up, do it up, do it up. Do it up, do it up, do it up. All these different versions are the first 3 notes of the symphony, either right side up or upside.
Yeah.
But best of all, in the cellos and basses, you have the meaning of life right there. What were the first 3 notes of the symphony? The first 3 notes were... That's all they play over and over again. Do it once, do it once. So it's like life is happening up here. Do it up, do it down. The meaning of life is there in the cellos, the first 3 notes of the symphony, over and over again. And at this great climax where everything is reduced to its pure cosmic essence, then the strings drop out. The woodwinds do nothing but some version of those 3 notes. They do it either down. Do it down, slide it down. Do it down, slide it down. Do it down, slide it down. Do it down. All versions of the first 3 notes of the symphony until magically we're back at the beginning. You know, there's that great quote from T.S. Eliot, "We shall never cease from exploration, and the goal of all our exploring will be to come back where we started and know the place for the first time. We come back, and after the journey of the piece, we now know the place for the first time."
Fabulous. Absolutely fantastic. Now, Rob, you were walking us through this on your keyboard here, but let's just take a second to listen to an orchestra.
Let's do it with orchestra, and there'll be voiceover from Rob so you don't miss a single item.
All right, go.
This is the opening. Do it once, do it twice, and then leap up. 3 notes down, 3 notes down, and this is the opening idea.
Yeah.
Let's now skip to that second section
where
it gets developed. End of first part. We think we know where we are. Transition. Huh? Where are we? Try to find a key, maybe here, okay? Change the end. Do it lower. Change the end again. Third time lower. Now, counterpoint. 4 bars long in the bass. Flip the parts up to the violins. 4 bars long. Flip it upside down again in the bass. 4 bars. Flip one more time. 1, 2, 3, 4. Reduce to just 2. 1, 2, 1, 2. 10 notes. Once, do it twice, and then repeat. Do it once, do it twice, and then... Now, just violins. Overlap with the 6-note version. Do it higher. 10 and 6. Higher. Now, just three. Just three. Just three. Six. Just three. Now, here, bass. Do it once. There's the first three notes of the symphony that cells and basses. Do it once. Transition, just woodwinds. All versions of the first three notes. And we are back. And know the place for the first time. There you go.
Oh, my God.
The mini version of
that
an hour
amazing.
At Jordan Hall. You just got the Reader's
Digest.
Do we still
amazing.
Have Reader's Digest? I don't know. If we do, that was the Reader's Digest
I want you to be on my perch on my shoulder every time I listen to any piece of music.
I'll die it immediately just to make sure it's not too much on your shoulder.
The fabulous Rob Kaplow. I can't stand that. That was so amazing. Now, so, you know, every time I hear a piece by Mozart, the only question I have is, how did he do it? But you just explained how did he do it. But this is a particularly emotional piece.
I mean,
what was going on in his life when he wrote it?
You know, it's when you say it's emotional, it's really true. And in fact, one of the things that's so odd about this piece, I mean, in general, classical period symphonies were like happy affairs. They had happy endings. They all ended in major keys. Even Beethoven never wrote a symphony that ended in a minor key. Mm. One of the extraordinary things about this piece is that one of only two symphonies of his 41 that's in a minor key, but this one actually ends in a minor key. It refuses that Beethoven victory of light over dark, triumph. It ends with tragedy, grief, and rage. And it was emotional and intense in a way that no other piece was at that time. You know, people can speculate a lot because there's wonderful mystery surrounding this piece. The truth is, nobody knows anything about it. All that people know is he wrote all three of his final symphonies in the sickeningly brief span of 9 weeks in the summer of 1788. No one knows whether he wrote them for any particular occasion, a particular orchestra.
Didn't one of his children die or something at that time?
There was no real death. It would be lovely to say his kids died and then he wrote sad music. But the thing is, Mozart was capable of writing incredibly happy music when his kids were deathly ill, including himself, and also capable of writing really sad music when things were going well. His circumstances in life were quite bad at this particular point in time, and he was losing money, he was losing popularity, he was no longer the hit Justin Bieber of his day. But you know, it's just an amazing mystery. No one really knows what it was written for or what the circumstances were.
Now, you said one of just two minor symphonies.
Yeah, there's another one called the Little G Minor Symphony because it's worse and it's earlier. But this is the major one. But none of them ending in a minor key was really a repudiation of the whole. I mean, you went to art, in other words, to not think about the horrible issues of the day. Yeah. They all ended in major keys. That's a really important fact. They all had upbeat, happy Disney endings, but not this one. And it refuses. And one of the things that we'll do in that program in Jordan is I'll show you all these major key ideas, but they come back in minor. So it's like you have this brief moment of hope and happiness when you first hear them, but then when they come back, it's all tragedy, grief, and rage. And I think that's one of the great things about Mozart is I often say that it's not about being, it's about becoming. Mm. In other words, when you hear this, it's nothing. We have no idea what it's going to be. It's not what it is when you first hear it. It's what it's going to become over the course of the piece. And that mini journey we took, that's what makes great classical music great. Yeah. Not what the idea is, but the possibilities that we can see hidden in it that no one else would see.
You know, whenever you come and you talk with us and you do your performances in Boston, I always feel like my eyes are being opened to a piece for the first time. How do you do this, Rob? I mean, do you just sit down with a great piece of music and you just like start note by note?
Well, you know, I think what it's really all about, and I often think it's not even about music, it's about paying attention.
Yeah.
You know, it's about learning how to listen. You know, you say your eyes are opening, but I'm also hoping that your ears are opening in the same, although it's a lot easier visual
but
to
metaphorical
see your eyes.
Eyes.
Yeah, but you know, but I do think it's about learning to pay attention. It's all right there in front of us, only we're not used to really listening. Whether it's a piece of great poetry, a piece of great literature, or a piece of great music. You know, my first book is entitled All You Have to Do Is Listen. And I think that that's really true, except listening is anything but all you have to do. It's a really complex process. So for me, I just sit and listen and try to notice what's there, try to hear what the composer is doing, because really, in a sense, all composition is about is listening for possibilities.
Yeah.
You have an idea and you think, what's possible? What could I create out of this? You know, Ezra Pound says, genius is the capacity to see 10 things where the ordinary man sees one.
Mm.
I mean, an ordinary Salieri would not have heard all the possibilities Mozart does. So mostly what I do is I sit and I listen and then try to share what I've listened with all of you and hopefully all the people who come to Jordan Hall.
Well, Rob Capello, conductor, composer, commentator, author, he will be doing just this. He'll be breaking down Mozart's Symphony No. 40 in G minor.
With a full orchestra.
And you'll be doing that on Sunday,
yep,
right?
As part
of the Celebrity Series at Jordan Hall. We've got information about that at our website, radioboston.org. And Rob, thank you so very much.
A pleasure to open your eyes and ears.
And, I mean, let's listen to Mozart as we go out. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.